Welcome to episode number 20 of the podcast One Way Or, Jewish Questions and Musings. I'm your host, Andrew Tertis, here with my co-host, Michael Unterberg.
How's it going, Andrew?
It's going great. We are here and having our Yetzir Hara and Yetzir HaTov episode after countless false starts. So let's talk about that. Okay, Dr. Ruth, would you chime in? Let's define our terms. On one hand, we have what I hear, Sitra Achra, which the other side, which mm-hmm. is sometimes it's explained to me as a spiritual force, and then that not something we have as much power with, but then the Yetzir Hara, which is often translated as the evil inclination. Mm-hmm. Yetzir Tov is the, I see, not as good inclination, but maybe good instinct. But I see so much more kind of dealt with with Yetzir Hara, the evil inclination, and dealing with that more, whether it's inner psychology, that which kind of tries to put barricades, blocks in front of our path and so forth, and Sitra Achra being like a much more out there. I'd like to see your kind of what your takes are on these.
Well, I don't know if there's a traditional philosophical approach that sees the evil inclination as a outside force. I think that's perhaps more of a folk religious idea. But in philosophy, it's generally seen as a personification of aspects of our personality.
All right. Not necessarily the most positive ones.
Well, by definition, sure. It's the part. It's used in different ways. It's sort of a catch-all term for personification of what leads us astray. Often, it's used in the way you sort of see it in movies and TV shows, where there's the, you know, the little shoulder guy pops up, and then the other shoulder guy, one's an angel and one's a devil, and
right.
So sometimes it's used in that way, as the metaphor is that we have two parts of our persona. One of them is the good side, one of them is the bad side. There's the Jekyll and the Hyde. There's another way that the rabbis use it, which is somewhat more subtle, which is that what they call the Yetzer Hara, this bad will, isn't evil. It's this raging force. And the Yetzer HaTov is the sort of control system for the force. The force itself, unshackled, is destructive, but when shackled, it's constructive. It's creative.
Well, and there's a number of stories which I know we'll talk about. Before that, just I did mention the Sitra Achra kind of as being an external force, or at least thought of. Or struggled with in that way.
Well, that's hard, because when you get to rabbinic writing and they're referring to it, is the author, it's hard to know authorial intent. Is the author working within the metaphor, or has the author taken the metaphor as a reality and is seeing it as an actual force in the world?
Well, I'll give a literary example.
Go ahead.
You know how much I love Rabbi Potok's, Chaim Potok's, My Name is Ashulev, mm-hmm. and then the follow-up, The Gift of Ashulev.
Mm-hmm.
So Ashulev, at the beginning of the story, is a five-year-old who's a gifted artist, and it's not that anyone in his family knows that he's gifted, or he does. He's both passionate and to some point obsessed, because he has these dreams, thunderous dreams of his great ancestor comes to him, leaves the taste of thunder in his mouth, and he wakes up and he's drawn with crayons on his wall. Now, for most modern kids in a Western type family, this would be interesting, but in his family it was as if the devil had come to the house,
mm-hmm.
or that he would write in the margins of his holy books and yeshiva without even really knowing. It was almost like, no, it was ambiguous, not that he was really possessed, it was just his creative force that was in him, but for his, according to his father's perspective, it was the other side, was the Sitra Achra.
Well, that's where it gets complicated, because you, I'm not sure you realize you use the term the devil, right? That's not a Jewish concept at all. So, and
some, I said that.
Yeah, you said to his family it would seem like the devil.
Right.
Part of what happens to Jews acculturate into their environments. So Jews in who come from Christian countries will often. Even Jewish, not only clothing will look like where they, but even ideas will begin to take on the garb of their host country. So a lot of Jewish language, we've talked about the Messiah and how a lot of that becomes tinged with Christian ideas. Even if we say Jesus isn't our Messiah, we're already talking in the same language as Christianity.
Right.
Well, so what is our Messiah? Well, it's not Jesus, but it's, we already have this Messiah idea, which has already taken some flavor from Christianity.
Right.
Sitra Achra, and this, you have in the Bible, for instance, in Job, or you'll have certainly a rabbinic idea of a prosecutor.
Right.
That we're, the metaphor being that we're being judged in heaven, and there's a defense and a prosecuting attorney, you know, defending attorney and a prosecuting attorney. The fact that in Christianity there became this sort of dual powers notion of an angel who falls and becomes the leader of hell, which also isn't a Jewish concept. So that Sitra Achra of being possessed by a demon, demonology in general, which maybe has some early, you can't go earlier than the Second Temple period if you're talking about it. Angelology or demonology. You have angels in the Bible, but they don't have a fleshed out, systematic understanding. They're just sort of characters in the story.
Right.
So, you know, angels and demons and all that sort of thing really comes later and becomes much bigger in Christian countries. And I think it's worthwhile really trying to keep it separate from this psychological metaphor, which sometimes also may be taken as personified, but I don't think is the same as, you know, what you're talking about, the father saying that's the Sitra Achra, this embodiment of temptation that's trying to lead you astray.
Right. He also sometimes would, as Asher got older and he started to paint nudes and other even more challenging, even some Christian symbols, that he'd say, you know, how could you do this and why can't you stop? Asher responded that he didn't really have control of this desire, and his father said, "What are you, an animal?" And so I could see in talking with you that his father is more seeing it as a character fault of Asher, not really.
You can more or less always turn these into you can always demetaphorize them,
mm-hmm.
and it makes sense psychologically. So at a certain point, it almost becomes irrelevant whether you take the personification literally or not. We personify by nature. You know, it's like an American electrical outlet looks like a face.
Yeah.
We can't help it.
Right.
You know, come on, you idiot car, start. What? What are you doing? We personify everything around us. So that tendency.
That my son, who's in his seventh year, is personifying quite a bit with that.
yeah, but even as adults, and we don't think that's strange that a person, we might laugh at it or giggle, but when we see a person talking to their coffee machine or what, you know, it just seems normal. Come on, you dumb computer, or oh, thank you, computer. Thank you, Wikipedia. So that can snowball over time so that a metaphorical rabbinic idea can become, through folkways and acculturation, can suddenly take on a life of its own. But I'm going to stand firm, I think, that at its root, it's meant as a metaphor.
Okay, well, I'd like to read a short piece, very short, piece by Rebbetzin Tzipora Heller that I liked. She gave 7 identities of the Yetzirah, just kind of to widen, see more of the different metaphors and then break them down a little bit. The Yetzirah has 7 names, which describe the ways we identify it. The list of names that the Gemara teaches us begins from the highest to the lowest awareness of how evil can distance us. Now, I know here she's saying, using the word evil, we'll talk. I know we're not going to go into the fully into that. The Gemara says Hashem called the Yetzirah evil. Moshe called it the uncircumcised one. David called it impure. Shlomo called it the enemy. Yeshaya called it the stumbling block. Yechezkel called it the stone. And Yoel called it the viper. One of those, the stone, that Yechezkel seeing at the stone, she mentions that we've all experienced times in our lives when our hearts were like stone, when our mitzvot weren't mitzvot and our tefillot, our prayer weren't tefillah, weren't prayer, and our love of our fellow Jew was mechanical. This reminds me of breaking it down as like a personal issue and how to wrestle with that, which the Musar, the Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, there's a lot of talk when he talks about Yetzirah, he's really looking at the psychological, the inner blocks and how to work with that.
Yeah, of course. That's actually, that particular block, which she's calling the stone, is one of the main themes of probably the greatest work of literature about the Yetzirah, C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters.
You've told me about them, I have not read them.
So it's just a wonderful work written as a series of letters. He's Christian, and he's writing as if a person's individual Yetzer Hara has been asking his supervisor in hell how best to lead his client to temptation. And we don't have his letters, we have that's Wormwood is the personal Yetzer Hara inhabiting a young, seemingly young adult British gentleman. And the letters that we have are the letters written back to him by his supervisor, Screwtape. And he's constantly telling him things like, why are you trying to not have him go to church? Have him go to church. The more mechanized you can do things, the safer he feels. If you push him out of church, he's going to say, something's missing in my life. But have him go to church mechanically, so that he's uninspired. Have him, while he's there, think about, I wonder if the guy next to me praying really is as sincere as his face looks. And you can get him there because he feels safe, because he's in church, so because he's doing the right thing. It's Lewis at his best, at his most psychologically insightful. It's sometimes devastating to read when you see yourself in there. But that's sort of, I think, what she's referring to when she says the stone.
Okay, that makes sense. I'm just thinking, because we just read Narnia, the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, to Lewis's original to Gabriel. So I'm just thinking, yeah, it's more, that's metaphorical. And actually, the character Edward, the brother, who is... he's wrestling with so much pain because he feels left out, he feels judged, and instead of looking at it his own inner journey, he then makes contract with the queen to try to ruin everybody. The Maharal, back to Rebbetzin Heller's work, she talks about that the Maharal describes the Yetzirah as that which conceals and makes Hashem seem absent, which resonates with me.
Well, if the point of any religion, but certainly Judaism, is to be closer to God, anything, including ritual, that separates you from God, that makes you lose focus on that prime goal, to be close to God and walk in His ways, is problematic, and it's built into organized religion. Or the pitfalls are already there when organized religion steps in to bring one away from God.
Can you say more what you mean there?
Well, I think it's really staying on the same idea that that there is such a thing as bad faith, where you're entering into a system of behaviors and rituals that you then say is making you pious, but as a matter of fact, it may actually be leading you away from God because you're pious. And this is a problem as old as the Bible. This is what the prophets are yelling about. This is Jeremiah is saying, you know, oh, that's so great that you're bringing these fantastic sacrifices and you're so ritually meticulous. And, you know, you trip over some poor guy in the street when you bring this fantastic sacrifice. God doesn't care about your sacrifice. He never asked for sacrifice. He asked you to take care of the widow and the orphan and the poor in your midst. So these rituals, which are whatever their purpose, and I guess that's a different podcast, you know, what's the purpose of ritual mitzvot, but whatever their purpose, there's certainly the walking in the ways of God, according to the rabbis, means being merciful and giving and humble. Forgiving and humble and truthful and all of those things. And sometimes it's the very rituals themselves that take our eye off the ball of those character building necessities that Judaism requires at its center, and we get caught up in the outer layers rather than the inner layers.
Right. And yeah, I agree.
That's something our Yetzer Hara gets us to do very easily.
There's another thing the Maharal says is that chametz, the yeast that we avoid during Pesach, that represents the Yetzer Hara.
Yeah, so Or Sheba Isa, the yeast in the dough.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, I was listening to Rabbi Noach Light on online, and he actually claims that Shavuot is the celebration of the Yetzer Hara. And the way he brings that teaching forth is that Shavuot is the only holiday, the only Yom Tov, where we actually offer chametz on the altar. That there's two loaves of bread instead of the unleavened bread, and that. And that the Maharal teaches on Shavuot that it's the commemoration of receiving the Torah, and it was based on the fact that we have a Yetzer Hara. And that then he goes to Shabbat 88b, which is the story of where Moshe goes to receive the Torah from God, and then the angels argue. Mm-hmm. So basically, the angels say, you know, how can you give it to him and to humans? Why don't you keep it with us?
Mm-hmm.
So my understanding is that Hashem then says, okay, go ahead, Moshe, what's your response? And that Moshe says, he reads from the Torah to them, I am the Lord your God who is taking you out of the land of Egypt, honor your parents. And then he asks, do you have a father or mother? Have you been enslaved in Egypt? Have you have a selfish and evil inclination? So all these questions, which the angels have to respond with, no, we don't. That Moshe then can argue that, well, we do. We have all these limitations, all these things we wrestle with. We the Torah is made for us because it's going to teach us, it's going to guide us, and that in effect.
Yeah. So what were the angels thinking exactly?
That's a good question.
I mean, they knew, right?
There's more. I've heard there's more than one level of Torah.
Exactly. I think that's what's going on in that story. That the angels fear that the primal, you know, primeval, God-created Torah written of black fire on white fire, this ideal, perhaps Platonic super Torah, was being leaked to mankind. And when Moshe explains, well, no, this, what, he doesn't say no, but he says, this is the one that talks about getting out of Egypt and honoring your parents, to which the angels are like, oh yeah, okay, you could have that Torah.
Well, maybe even much more profound than a Platonic Torah, that like a quantum mechanics or nuclear Torah, where the secrets of not only of creation but destruction, everything is in there, that like total raw power where everything's possible.
they fear there's a level of reality being pierced in Moshe's understanding, and they're mistaken. And God doesn't say, interestingly, God doesn't answer them. He says, Moshe, you answer them. And when they hear Moshe talking, they realize he's assimilated the most a human being can assimilate, but he hasn't transcended that. And so they're assuaged.
I'd like to explore this more, because for the Torah that Moshe then argued for, which is still higher than the levels of awareness that humanity had at the time and has, and in so many ways is still, that humanity as a whole and Jews as a group haven't fulfilled, you know, clearing the Yetzer Hara from the negative influence and then just fulfilling on positive, the influence of just having
desire. Well, again, I mean, this Seor B'Shabaisa imagery, this yeast in the dough. Yeast is not a bad thing. Have you ever eaten a handful of yeast?
No.
That would be, I don't know if it's bad for you. Is that bad for you?
Well, okay, here's, back then, the yeast that they had back then is also
sourdough.
Right. Now that's what I eat. And that's what we just...
You eat the sourdough?
No, I don't eat the... But that would be...
You make dough rise with sourdough.
Right, but the right now... But what the modern consumption of yeast is a factory product, which is chemically based, so that would be even more dangerous than just eating some sourdough.
Probably, but let's say you took that chunk... Sourdough is... You leave the bread...
It's flour.
Right.
In water, mixed and left in the air. You know, left out until it bubbles, and that takes a few days the first time. And so what that's doing is that's actually naturally harvesting yeast from the air,
mm-hmm.
which is a bacteria which stimulates growth. Now, if you have too much of it, then the body has a hard time. It fatigues people. And
what would happen if you ate that bubbling sourdough?
It would be harder to digest because it wasn't cooked.
Let's say you cook that.
Well, if you cook
into
that,
bread,
it's just,
that sourdough bread, that's okay to eat?
Yeah. But there's a whole, I mean, this is a whole, I have much more.
Normally what you do is you take that sourdough and put it into another dough, and that allows the dough to rise.
Well, you make a dough using that as the base with water.
As the base.
And then you let it sit out for half a day or overnight.
That's just bread rising. But what happens if you just eat the sourdough?
Cook
this is not,
rough.
By the way, if you've just tuned into this podcast, which can't happen because nobody just tunes into a podcast, but if you've just tuned into this podcast, this is not Baking with Andrew and Mike. This is One Way or Jewish Questions and Millie Sings.
Although we should do a
maybe
episode
one day. One day. But I do think it's worth, I think your point is correct, that when we hear Seor, we think yeast, and when the metaphor was created, they're not referring to yeast. So they're referring to sourdough. So I would like to understand sourdough. I think we get it. If you just ate sourdough, or say made a roll out of this intense sourdough, it wouldn't be easily digestible.
Well, if you cooked it, it would be fine. It would actually, it would just be very sour. I mean, I like a very sour bread. It would be more like a pancake if you're only taking that, because you use just a fraction of it in the...
It takes very little to add to the other bread to get it to rise.
For example, you'll add a cup of this liquidy sourdough starter to another 5-6 cups of flour plus a few cups of water. So it's there. There's presence. It's just you're not eating it straight.
So that's, I think, what Sitra Achra is. It's something inside you that without it, things don't rise. Things are flat. On its own, it's problematic, but combined with everything else, it's that drive to rise. It's the drive to create.
Okay, so I like what you're drawing out here, because it clearly wouldn't be for most people successful or healthy in any way to just each time they make a bread to have more and more sourdough, like to fill it and fill it until
it has to be within the plain dough,
right?
The fresh dough,
right? And And, you know, the same thing with the balance of using sitracha to, or in the yetzerah to actually motivate oneself to overcome obstacles.
No, so what I'm saying is this particular, there's the rabbinic metaphor of the yetzerah as the force that gets you to do evil. And then there's the rabbinic metaphor that it's not the force that makes you do evil. It's the force. Mm-hmm. It is your creative force. Now, unshackled, it's bad. With a Yetzer HaTov, it's good.
Right.
This is an idea that appears many times in rabbinic literature. For instance, on the sixth day, God says it is good twice. There's a midrash that says the first one is for the Yetzer HaTov, the second one's for the Yetzer Hara. It's the only day.
And also Tov Me'od, isn't it?
Tov Me'od, I think that's it, yeah. Why is it Tov Me'od? That's for the Yetzer Hara. And of course, there's the famous Agadata in the Gemara about after the destruction of the first temple, the leaders asked to have, it's a long, complicated, we'll give a link to this long rabbinic Agadata, but basically the short version is, and I was, by the way, as a kid, I was always told that we no longer have the Yetzer Hara for idolatry because it was destroyed after the destruction of the first temple. You can imagine my surprise when, as an adult, I realized that that is an agada meant as literature, not a historical event. But basically, they say to God, "We can't handle it anymore. It's destroyed the temple. It's killed our prophets. This Yetzer Hara for idolatry is too powerful." And the Navi intercedes and says, "Be very careful." And it's delivered to them in the form of a fiery lion that comes out of where the temple was, and they lock it in a lead box, and they see that they're in a moment of success, so they ask for the bigger Yetzer Hara, which Rashi and the Gemara explains is for sexual desire. And again, the Navi warns them, and they chain it because they don't want to hurt it, because the Navi warned them, and they search the length and breadth of Israel and find no fresh eggs. So they decide to blind it and set it loose again, because otherwise the world would be destroyed.
But there was more than just not fresh eggs, right? I mean, there was nothing happening. People weren't going to work, or is that just...
Well, fire? They don't say that. Yeah, they don't say that. They say, that if I remember the Agadata correctly, it just says there's no egg, which is... It's meant as a symbol, in other words. And that's clearly using this image of the Yetzer Hara as this driving force, that if you take away that driving force, you lose the energy to push the limits further. That limit, that boundless, limitless energy that needs to find, to fill its container, to go as far as it can and then burst the container open. That energy is what drives us. And the Yetzer HaTov is the thing that contains and directs it. You know, you can use whatever metaphor you want. It could be a fire and, you know, a forest fire versus a fireplace, which contains it, or mm-hmm. your nuclear control rods, or Captain Kirk being split into two beings by a transporter malfunction. Did you ever see that? The Enemy Within?
I think so.
It's a great one. And it really what's amazing is it's season one of Star Trek, and they're already tapping into, I'm sure accidentally, into rabbinic thought, that it's a Jekyll and Hyde-like episode. There's the good Kirk and the bad Kirk. And what they discover is that, you know, the bad Kirk is harassing women and stealing booze and drinking it and doing terrible things. And the good Kirk can't make a decision. You know, Captain Kirk's driving characteristic is he always knows what to do in it. He's the guy who can decide what to do, and it's always the right call. And he becomes wishy-washy. He simply can't make a decision. He becomes... And what he discusses with his crew, you know, Spock and Bones, what he discusses is that there's... It's not... You can't separate that neatly between good and bad. Without mm-hmm. without that driving force, which is that ragged, almost barbaric aspect to his personality, he doesn't have the guts to make these decisions. He doesn't have the driving force or not really the charisma, but he doesn't have, there's a certain amount of ego involved in saying, I know right. what to do, that a leader needs to have. He's missing all of those faculties, and they, luckily they fixed the transporter and everything's okay.
But. Well, I'm going to move out of the Jewish frame for a minute. I've been.
That's fair, because I was discussing Star Trek.
Yeah.
So that well, was within.
But at least so that was going, yeah, a parallel, right?
No, I'm with you 100%.
As you know, I've been reading and rereading Brian Swim's The Mathematical Cosmologist's Narrative of Cosmology of Creation till now, called The Universe is a Green Dragon. And in this story, which really begins with what he calls the primeval fireball, he doesn't call it a Big Bang, but this first light, this first explosion.
That, energy release.
Yeah, that all matter that now fills, that is, makes
all everything.
Yeah. All everything that we know of. And that we're now just, scientists recently in the past years have been actually being able to see the light from that primeval fireball. So he introduces the allurement, the attraction, the desire, and replaces the word gravity for planets and for galaxies, for pulling each other towards or pulling towards each other, and then all the way to what's on the Earth, and even for calling human love as part of overall cosmic allurement, and that each being, each creation has allurement, and there's that by being a created being, where you actually then get in touch with what you're allured to, what we're allured to, and then following that and pursuing that, then one passion opens to another. He gave an example of someone who is just loves Shakespeare and reads Shakespeare, that over time, going deeper and deeper and deeper in wrestling, one will then have more understanding of humanity because of Shakespeare's mastery with human relationship. So it reminds me of, is it Bly, Robert Bly, who talks about following your bliss? It's following one's allurement into the deepest realm is, in a way, being a part of the universe, because that every creature, every being, even if it's a galaxy, a planet, or a frog, is being itself to its fullest and following its desires and passions, and that for humans, part of that is probing the depths of creation, which ultimately has led to nuclear physics and other pursuits, which just as for the pursuits themselves are not evil, but in that there is this desire to then create something destructive out of power and
but that's the yeast and the dough that unshackled right. It's sour and within the new dough it makes it fantastic. It's the same, the drive itself is amoral. It's the drive.
Right.
And nuclear energy can power a city or destroy a city in seconds. So, yeah. And that humankind following what it means to be human.
But it's interesting, going back, yes, it could power a city, but even actually following through and creating, mixing or fusing the matter that will then do that, we don't have the understanding of how to be safe with that.
Well, yeah, we're not fusing. We're fissioning.
Fissioning. Yeah. We're not safe with that.
No,
so,
we haven't come up with the safe
process. Incredibly exciting. It's still a following the beauty and exploring beauty, but at some point we haven't had the wherewithal to then stop and say, you know, wait a second. Oh, I wish I can go further here, but you know what? It's just not safe.
Human civilization is in a race between its intellectual maturity and its moral maturity. Mm-hmm. And we better hope that the moral maturity wins because of that danger, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what civilization is, that race.
Right. Well, we were talking about the Adam and Eve and eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And my question to you about, could it have been that it was just too early for them to eat it? Still waiting to see a friend's commentary on that. But the idea that, you know, what if this was...
It was only a temporary command from God not to eat of it. They were meant to eat of it. What he meant was just not now.
Right, but that God couldn't say not now, because then it would place it as a temporary idea, but it had to be permanent until God said differently.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, humanity has been dealing with desire for all time. And one thing, going back to Brian Swinn's book, work, is that there's the possibility of being beauty and living beautifully and having surprise, being in a surprising and adventurous existence, and through that having satisfaction for actually being a living inheritor of the of evolutionary creation of process, as opposed to looking outside and consuming beauty or searching for an experience out there in the world that will then give the feeling of surprise and adventure. And I think this is a split that we really have an issue with now, is
it's not something you acquire, it's something you aspire to.
What, can you say more about that?
It's not something externally that you try to absorb, it's something that you contribute.
Right. If you find the beauty inside, like if we're looking at each other, at other people, and seeing each person as created in the image of God, and we see the river, we see the moon, we see a fish, and say, wow, these are all brilliantly, beautifully, complexly created beings, and there's a mystery behind there, and if I can just engage without trying to take and consume this other being, creature, or experience, but kind of be in it, and then from that be fulfilled, and then bring my interest, my passion, and my gratitude to the table, which then adds then this is an internal experience versus a objectifying the world and then consuming it.
I really love that your idea of the Eden story being God's statement of, here's how things will develop. You don't do this now, and you're going to develop in method A, but they do eat from the tree of knowledge, and that changes modes. Now you're going to have to go through the development of civilization through history, through path B, where you're going to have to struggle to make your bread, where you're going to become people of the earth, where there was this possibility of mankind developing in a very different path than the one that we're on now, where we are now on this race between our moral development and our, you know, intellectual, technological, scientific development.
Well, I'm just going to play it back to you, like, argue a little. Of, what if plan B was just in timing? It was just plan A, but with more maturity. Or that what you're calling plan B was just step two of plan A, and that that once it was time, the fruit was ripe, the first fruits were taken, and then God says, okay, now I invite you to partake in this, because Adam and Eve had some kind of maturity that could discern between this desire, so that the can fulfill humanity's mission of being the self-consciousness, the self-reflexive awareness of the earth, and to bring the, I'm also drawing this from Brian Swim, actually letting the earth and all creation and the universe even know its beauty through our perception. And then instead of consuming everything, kind of finding a dance, which is wonderful for us, we're getting our needs met, but also adding as opposed to going on this hungry path of...
I mean, it's your metaphor, so you can use it. Like, I'm not... I don't mean to co-opt your metaphor.
Oh, sure. But, I mean, use it how you want. I just
in the text that I see of the story of the expulsion from Eden, I see a paradigm shift. It's not just a, now you've skipped a lot of steps. It's you're now set back steps in a certain way, and there's something different going on. You now notice you don't have clothes, and now... how you eat is going to be different, and how you relate to each other in different genders is going to be different, and how you reproduce the effects of creating children is going to work somehow differently. There's something that's changed in a way that's...
Right, but it's not totally depressing because they leave the garden and Adam calls Eve Chava.
No, I think that like anything else, there's... If you view the expulsion from Eden as a step down or a step up, you're probably right either way. There are things that are eating from the tree of knowledge.
Good and evil.
Yeah, I'm not sure about what good and evil means.
Right, but it's still there in the text.
There's in ancient Near East, right, when in ancient Near East, when in ancient Near Eastern literature, and I forgot the technical term for it, but there, it's sort of like in English when we say from A to Z. You would, in ancient Near Eastern languages, when you would say opposites, from black to white, from up to down, from good to evil, so you meant everything. It was just, that was an idiom. So I'm not sure that it literally is referring to good and evil, although that's Tov and Ra mean, and that's how we, but we, I fear that we're reading it without understanding the idiom, which would make it Tree of Knowledge.
Right, but a lot of people just call it the Tree of Knowledge, and I think even, but that's also missing something, because...
I don't know. There's a lot of rough imagery in the story that's hard to decode, and that's why we've spent the last however many thousand years trying to get to the bottom of what it's saying, and that's why we can have different readings. But there is something in there about temptation, and there is something about knowledge achieved without maturity has consequences.
Right.
And those consequences sometimes mean certainly a harder path. And perhaps a less harmonious path. Perhaps a path that's going to have sweat and toil and pain, which the implication is would not have had. Which is why I'm seeing them as path A and path B.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I'd like to bring this to a more personal level and see what... How does the Yetzer Hara talk to you? What kind of, what does the voice that to convince you or block you from, you know, your higher pursuits or your desires?
Well, you know me. I mean, for me, it's a weird mixture of a real lack of self-confidence, a real lack of self-appreciation, combined with, seemingly paradoxically, this feeling of being a perfectionist. Well, if I can't get it totally right, I'm not going to try. I guess it's fear of failure, I guess, isn't really perfectionism. Mm-hmm. Which I guess is actually, now that I say it out loud, more related to the self-confidence, self-regard problem, self-esteem issues, mm-hmm. I guess.
And how do you, what are your, the antidotes you use to counter that?
Mm-hmm.
Other than reading nonstop.
Well, no, I mean, what you said earlier, you know, about following your attractions. Like for me, that quest to satisfy my curiosity of finding God in the world, and certainly in the Torah and in the accumulated wisdom of primarily the Jewish people, but also humanity. And what that does to bring you closer to God, that's an addiction I can't deny. And I think that's probably satisfying your curiosity. The more you learn, you know, the sort of the broader the circumference of what you know, the more things you have to be curious about. Because something that's far away from the circumference of what you know, you're not aware of, you can't be. So if you know more and then your circumference grows, I guess there's really no point in a podcast of me doing the hand I talk with my hands even on a podcast.
Well, but, I do too. I nod a lot.
Yeah, and, yeah, I also do. So, no, but that means you have an exponentially growing world of things you're curious about, and that, so it really is this sort of cycle of, it's this addictive cycle, and right, I think that's a great addiction.
Right, I mean, because addiction.
But I don't think that makes me a better person. It makes me. You're talking about my reading a lot, is because I just aggressively need to consume more about the world.
But this curiosity, I do see it result in you being a better person.
Hopefully,
in the sense that, okay, since I'm calling better, I'll define how I'm using that. In the sense that you're looking at others, the other, with more openness and less judgment of them. Now, you have your issue, you're saying, with yourself and about self-judgment, but that you rarely exercise that with someone else.
Yeah, you have an exponentially growing empathy along with it as you connect to things that make us human.
So yeah, now, as a writer, I mean, you're a writer
now
too.
Now on you, man.
Yeah.
What's your Yetzirah voice?
Impatience, anger, frustration, self-judgment, and righteousness.
Wow, you pulled that out fast. That came right out of the holster. Say those again.
Yeah, I wrote them down.
You're keeping. Well,
maybe they're a good acronym. Let's see. Impatience, anger, frustration, self-judgment, and righteousness. I could probably get RAFES if I get an acronym from.
We might want to fine-tune that.
I'll work
a better anagram. Impatience, anger, frustration.
What are you? How many times do you have to say?
Self-judgment and...
Righteousness.
Righteousness. What do you mean by righteous? Self-righteousness? You mean like...
Yeah. Yeah. But I also have... A lot of these come from the times where I also have low self-esteem and...
Because I would think that self-judgment, at least at the surface, self-judgment and self-righteousness would seem to be contradictory, right?
Well, I'm Avram Eliezer. So the patriarch and his slave, you know, both. I think it's, that's what's so beautiful about being a human is there's so many polarities right in each person.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking about personal stories with someone at a campfire the other night. And just someone who I'd known for years and never had a conversation with, because there's just always, whenever we were together, it's always someone else I'd talk to. And just hearing his story, and it just opened up this wonder and this desire to know this person more. And for people who I've had lots of judgment for in the past, people I really didn't like or I had real attitudes about, as soon as I found out about from their side, you know, mm-hmm. inside their skin, inside their head, how things work, it always opens something up of curiosity in me and compassion. And that's what I have to work on for myself. And like,
so you're saying that the way to counter those voices is compassion, empathy, love?
Well, to counter those things, what works well for me is to actually listen to someone, to their story, before I just close the book on what I think their story is and how I judge it. It works for me too. If it's something that in the current manuscript that I had had a real hard time with the villain, and until I've really saw this person as a human with actually some positive qualities, and then the foibles not being solely from his own self-righteousness, but from like just all other reasons, like, and opening my compassion, I finally sighed relief that okay, a representation of a real type person is forming.
Mm-hmm.
But the ways I deal with it though is the best, like if I'm really stuck with these voices is dancing, singing, walking in nature, baking. You know, cooking good food or something like that, doing Jinshin Jitsu, praying.
That's a pretty good list too. Dang it! I got nothing. Yeah, you have such good lists.
Well, I do use a lot more ink in these sessions.
Yeah, that's for sure true. I'm a much more paperless fellow.
As we close this episode number 20 of our podcast, One Way or Jewish Questions and Musings, I'd like to put it to you, audience. What's your Yetzirah? What kind of things do you deal with? What would you, what topics would you like to explore? We'd love to hear from you. And you can reach us by going to onewayor.com and
at One Way Or Podcast on Twitter or Facebook.
Thank you, Michael. And love to hear from you. The music is brought to you by Jewish blues pioneer Saul Kaye.
Bye.
Goodbye.